coming up in this episode. And I imagine this is all well documented in the book, right? Lots of drama in this section of the book.
He wasn't the type you would necessarily mark for leadership. He came from a rural Alabama background. He spoke with a thick rural accent and a bit of a stammer.
And I'm sure there are experts on the civil rights movement who know a lot, and they will learn a lot here too.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge.
All right, Orlando, time to talk about books. And I understand you've got a big one for me this time.
Yeah, this one was 700 pages, okay? 700 pages. John Lewis, A Life by David Greenberg. A very long but very gripping tale in parts. A lot of fascinating stories that I didn't know about the man behind the icon.
Okay, so long book we mentioned. We always make an effort in this podcast to read the entire book.
I mean, that's what I do. If you don't read the entire book, how can you talk about it?
So you've got other job duties as well. So, I mean, just curious, how do you manage to squeeze a 700-page book into your routine here?
Well, it was an audiobook, so I experienced it as an audiobook. It was 24 hours as an audiobook.
Did the author read his own work?
No. Okay. No, it was very well read. But, you know, you take it in the commute, you take it doing chores, you take it taking a shower, you take it while resting, you take it before bed, and 24 hours is perfectly manageable in that situation.
Okay, so what's your best pitch as to why I should invest myself in a book of this length?
Well, it's all about what you don't know. Mm-hmm. What you don't know. And I don't know what you know about John Lewis, and I'm sure there are experts on the civil rights movement who know a lot, and they will learn a lot here too. So, you know, I'm from a much lower level of knowledge, I have to say. I've only been in Atlanta 3 years. I know you've been in Atlanta for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of organized this today into sort of the five things that I didn't know about John Lewis. Can we do it that way?
I would love to.
Breaking format a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about John Lewis either, except for the broad strokes. And living in Atlanta, you just sort of absorb it by osmosis, kind of. But yeah, I'd love to know the details. Okay, so tell us a little bit about how he emerged as a leader. What defined him as a leader?
Well, the first thing that I found surprising was that he was an unlikely leader. Mm-hmm. When you look at this guy, when you hear this guy, you might ask yourself, how did he rise from his origins to become one of the prominent figures in the 20th century? And I'll introduce the author, David Greenberg, at this point.
He wasn't the type you would necessarily mark for leadership. He came from a rural Alabama background. He spoke with a thick rural accent and a bit of a stammer. When he got to the American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, not itself not a particularly big place, even there he seemed kind of a bit of an outsider, pure hick, his friend Bernard Lafayette said. And he was shy. He lacked a certain amount of self-confidence. And yet, within a short time, certain natural leadership qualities emerged in him.
And Greenberg doesn't even go into a lot of it there. This guy was dirt poor. We're talking on a farm in rural Alabama near Troy. Mm. And not only that, but, you know, as he sort of was young and even emerging throughout his life, he had frumpy dress. He was hard to understand. And he was a very serious man, very preacherly, you know. And when all the young people, they don't want to be around this preacherly, moralistic, very serious guy. So, you know, in his early years, there were certainly other more debonair and suave leaders.
Hmm. Yeah, and I'm curious about how he did develop that confidence.
It was the Crucible of Nashville.
The Crucible of Nashville.
I'm going to call it the Crucible of Nashville. I'm making up that term.
Okay.
I'm just making up that term. That's where he started with the lunch counter sit-ins, with the theater protests and the organizing details that you need to lead such a movement. I'm talking about printing flyers, calling meetings, asking people to show up for the meetings, asking people to show up again, training people and training people again, because, you know, these people were being beaten, they were being yelled at and arrested, and he never responded with this hatred, with violence. He was always calm. He was always the first to arrive, the last to leave, always tireless, and he never let the hatred infect him. And so I think that the second thing that really surprised me about John Lewis's life was his lifelong non-negotiable belief in nonviolence.
The first time I got arrested was February 1960. I felt so free.
Really?
I felt liberated. I felt like I crossed over because I had been told by my parents and others, don't get in trouble. But it was good trouble. It was necessary trouble.
Good trouble. That's the classic phrase.
That's his signature phrase. People saw this commitment. They saw this sacrifice being bloodied, being almost killed on the Selma Bridge. He was called a saint. And people want to emulate that. That's how he became a leader. When you ask the question, how did he become a leader? That's how. You know, why do we have saints in the Catholic Church? You're former Catholic. You know? You have saints because there's people to look up to. And so it was that unwavering commitment that was important when he, especially when the movement started to fracture.
Fracture. What are you talking? Are you talking about the Black Power and more radical militant expressions of the movement?
Yeah, exactly. Think about this. After the Freedom Rides, after Bloody Sunday, after the March on Washington, after his stunning leadership of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he was forced out as SNCC in this very hurtful ouster. Because at that point, the young people were shifting to a more, like you said, more radical, more militant expressions of civil rights. And this ouster in 1966 really hurt him. For the rest of his life, it was a turning point, and he was only age 26.
It's a low moment for him. The civil rights movement, and in particular SNCC, the organization he led, has moved away from the ideals of nonviolence and interracial cooperation toward a more Black separatist philosophy. Lewis leaves Atlanta, spends a sort of unhappy year in New York City, then gets back into politics working for Robert F. Kennedy's 1968 campaign, but that spring has to withstand and suffer the assassinations of both Martin Luther King, his great mentor and idol, and of Robert Kennedy, who he sort of had seen as claiming King's mantle.
So how did he handle this low point?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with his meeting his future wife, Lillian Miles. And Lillian is a force throughout this entire book. She helped him, really defended him. She was in some way his organizer. It was also his fulfilling work in voter education. He landed several jobs, you know, both in private and in public work, doing voter education.
So did he ever forgive the people who had ousted him?
Eventually, yes.
Eventually.
Stokely Carmichael was the one in particular. Stokely Carmichael and his allies who took over SNCC. But he didn't speak ill of them after it immediately happened. He sort of thought that the cause was more important than this petty infighting, and so he sort of kept his calm. You know, he didn't let the event boil over him at the moment, and he just kept it to itself, and he moved on. SNCC eventually died in the early 70s. Later in his career, his sort of feelings about all that cooled.
And I imagine this is all well documented in the book, right? Lots of drama in this section of the book.
Yes, there are lots of drama. And that's the third thing that I didn't know about John Lewis. And that's his clashes with certain people, specifically Julian Bond and Jimmy Carter. Julian Bond was his best friend. They were very tight. They hung out together. They were soldiers in the movement. Their wives and kids hung out together. They grew up, you know, in SNCC, and Bond later went on to form the Southern Poverty Law Center. Bond went on to a career in the State House and Senate. But it was that 1986 when they both decided to run for Congress. first they started out kind of civil in this race, and then things got nasty.
Because this is a primary, right?
Yes. So the primary was going to win the general election.
Got it. Okay. So what was nasty about this?
Well, the headline in that race, in that nastiness, was the cocaine.
Oh, no.
So
whose cocaine?
Julian Bonds.
So allegedly Julian Bonds or definitely Julian Bonds?
Allegedly Julian Bonds. And I want to definitely say that this was like rumors and sort of people had sort of heard that Julian Bond was doing cocaine, and Lewis stayed away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Lewis stayed away from it until the very end.
And directly or through surrogates?
Directly.
Wow.
Directly. So
would never have guessed given his reputation.
Well, I think there also was a lot of difference between them in style and substance as well, because Bond was from a well-heeled black family. His father was a college president. Bond's childhood home was filled with people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson. He was well-spoken. He had nice clothes. He drove a fancy car. He was Northern educated. And on the other hand, you had Lewis, who was this dowdy son of sharecroppers, Southern educated, very religious. And you know, there were just two different appeals. Lewis also appealed to white people in a diverse Atlanta district. Lewis always believed in multiracial coalitions. LGBTQ people, he reached out to. Jewish people, he reached out to. And in that nasty campaign, there were whispers of, you know, Lewis is not black enough, you know. Mm. And in fact, Bond made an unfortunate comment about Lewis being more concerned with the citizens north of I-20, and we know that that means white. Mm-hmm. So in this very close race, it turned nasty at the end.
So what about the Jimmy Carter fight? What was it about their relationship that just didn't gel?
So the Lewis clash with Jimmy Carter wasn't as dramatic or painful or hurtful as the clash with Bond. But I'll introduce this clip by Greenberg, who'll answer the question, by just saying that Lewis did work for Carter in the last few years of Carter's administration for an agency that was aimed at helping the poor by overseeing some volunteer-based organizations.
By the end of Carter's presidency, when Ted Kennedy, who was a great friend of John Lewis's, decided to challenge Carter for the Democratic nomination, Lewis was quite torn. You know, his heart really was with Ted Kennedy, but he also was enough of a loyal man that he wasn't going to publicly betray Carter. So he ended up resigning a little early from the Carter administration and sort of sitting it out. He later then tussled with Carter in Atlanta over fights over building a parkway out to the Jimmy Carter Library, where John Lewis fought with the preservationists, the environmentalists who wanted to protect a lot of the green space that was going to be destroyed by that highway.
And so you probably drive on that highway from time to time.
Yeah, for folks who aren't fully aware, the John Lewis Freedom Parkway like basically wraps around the Carter Center in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. It's now called the John Lewis Freedom Parkway, but it was originally the Presidential Parkway.
Hmm.
And it was originally, and I don't know if you know this history, but it was originally planned out to go much further out and destroy a lot of neighborhoods and connect with other highways. It was part of a big, you know, mid-20th century plan to just pave over everything and build highways.
But it basically stops at a giant park now.
Now it just stops at a giant park.
Which is a very pretty park. I've biked there. Have mm-hmm. you?
Yeah,
I
did so the other day. But, you know, he and others stopped this highway. They fought successfully to stop it. And that was one of the causes that sort of endeared him to voters in some of the wealthier, whiter neighborhoods, because those were the neighborhoods that it was going to go through. But again, he thought it was just something that was wrong, and so he stood against it.
So interesting that the highway gets his name right outside the Carter Library.
It's certainly ironic that it's called the John Lewis Freedom Parkway when he fought to stop it. Mm-hmm. He certainly did not clash with Carter, you know, and like I said, in the way that he did with Bond. He admired the Georgia governor who took Georgia out of its segregationist past. But there was, again, that primary fight and the highway fight.
All right. So you counted three things that surprised you. You promised five. You've got two more, I believe.
Yes. Fourth thing that I did not know about John Lewis is just how much of a rock star he was. Did you know how much of a rock star this guy was?
I get the sense toward the end of his life that, yeah, he was just kind of an institution, really.
This guy was He was a sought-after speaker, so he could be deployed to congressional districts around the country to raise lots and lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
But then just ordinary people on the street, they would see him and want to go up to him, and they would cry when they met him. And, you know, just the other weekend, I was talking about this with a friend that I'm going to talk about this subject. And he said, oh, I met John Lewis in the ATL airport, the Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, and he was on the shoeshine, and, you know, and he said hello and took my picture and all that. You know, he loves signing autographs, sometimes to the consternation of his staff, who always wanted him to move along. But he was such a rock star. Did you know about the Stephen Colbert crowd surfing video?
No, I did not know this one. He crowd surfed?
He crowd surfed. The man was 70-something years old. And he goes on Stephen Colbert, and he goes out into the crowd and gets crowd surfed. I had to look up the video.
He jumped off a stage into a crowd of people, or they picked him up?
It was more like leaning into the crowd.
Yeah, okay.
And then the crowd took him along. But yeah, it was, that's how much of, and it went viral. And of course, you know, that was one thing I didn't know, just how much of a rock star. And the fifth and final thing that I'll mention is I did not know that in Congress, he actually was not much of a policy wonk. I mean, for all of his rock star status, the book sort of points out that getting legislation passed was not his strong suit in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Who is good at that right now? I'd love to know.
Well, not many people, I guess.
Yeah.
But
in his defense, I suppose I could say that.
You can say that about anybody.
Yeah,
really.
Anything that's not very obviously bipartisan is going to get stalled at some level.
No, he was not, you know, let's count the votes, let's wrangle politics, let's research the policies. He was more like the moral force. His word had tremendous influence, and he was called the conscience of the Congress. That's another phrase that often comes up about him. He was the conscience of the Congress, but the details, legislating, not much his thing. I think he much more liked being, you know, this sort of rock star person.
He learned to be a good congressman and sort of bring home the bacon for his district, helping Atlanta with airport funding and highway funding that helped make it the big, dynamic, entrepreneurial city that it was becoming. At other times, he accepted compromises when he realized that in a divided country with divided government, where the Republicans had a lot of power, you had to accept a bill that maybe was not quite all you wanted it to be. So some people might see opportunism or too much of a willingness to fall in line with the Democratic Party. But John Lewis saw this as getting stuff done.
He got stuff done for his district by bringing home the bacon.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as big legislative accomplishments that affect people nationally, I think the biggest thing that the book pointed out was the law that created the National African American Museum. That was his biggest legislative accomplishment. It took 15 years. There were many hurdles for him to overcome to get that done. But that was sort of his biggest accomplishment as a lawmaker, according to the book.
So he died a few years ago. How does the author write about his death?
Well, it's very sad. And I have to say, I started to cry at the end. And who wouldn't when you hear about, you know, the man's life and the people that he loved and the things that he cared about? And the end was pancreatic cancer. And it came rather suddenly, as pancreatic cancer does. My own mother died of pancreatic cancer. And it came during the height of COVID. And for this man to be so active, to always be this energetic person, and just to see him die like that, it was very sad.
Sorry about your mom, by the way. So what gives this book the narrative edge?
It's a major biography of a major figure in U.S. history. Let's just start there, okay? And I think it's written from a perspective of bringing you to the scene. It puts you in the minds of the people who were there at the time, what they were thinking, you know. We see and we hear about Bloody Sunday and the Freedom Rides, but what actually happened, like the moment-to-moment, day-to-day things, the logistics of it, how things could have turned out differently, it's very surprising.
Hmm.
And it answered a lot of questions for me. It was long, but it was worth it. I mean, and especially if you have a character like this one. I mean, when he was asked about his greatest accomplishment, and these clips, by the way, that I've been playing come from a GPB interview from, I believe, 2006. But when he was asked about his greatest accomplishment, here's what he had to say.
I find a way to get in the way. I think you just have to get in the way. You don't have to be popular. Just when you see something that is not right, speak up. When you see something that is so wrong and so evil and so vicious, when someone has been put down because of their race, their color, their religion, their nationality, or whatever, you have to do something. You cannot afford to be silent. You have to do something. You have to make some noise. I said to young people today, I said, we are too quiet. We need to make a little noise. My generation, we were not quiet. We made a little noise.
And that's why the book is worth reading.
It was so cool to hear him say, found a way to get in the way. A great way of putting it.
That was what he saw as his life's greatest work.
Well, the book is John Lewis, A Life by David Greenberg. Orlando, thank you for reading it.
Thank you. It's been a long book. It's been a long podcast, but...
but worth it. Well, worth it.
Definitely worth it. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB news podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.